My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. In his book, Strange Creatures from Time and Space, John Keel discussed window areas and found himself smack in the middle of one during his 13 months visiting Point Pleasant in West Virginia. Around the world, we've become aware of several others, from the Bridgewater Triangle, the area around Mount Shasta, the Dragon's Triangle in the Pacific, to the Peak District, here on my doorstep in Sheffield. But there's another one, on the other side of Yorkshire, along the East Coast, and luckily for us, one man has been cataloguing, investigating, and writing about it, all for our benefit. And of course, that man is Paul Sinclair. Since Paul first appeared back on episode 39, I've continually received emails and messages asking when he'd be returning to the show. So no doubt, you'll be delighted to hear us discuss new cases, new witnesses, and more high strangeness. Paul is someone I've got to know quite well, so it's a pleasure to let you all listen in to one of our conversations and the baffling variety of phenomena occurring out on the East Coast and Paul's upcoming book, The Night People. So June is upon us already, but despite lockdown, there's still a lot going on. Nash and the Chasing Legends team have launched their Kickstarter after delaying it. So check out this week's show notes for the link if you'd like to help them out. Chandler Groh's latest book, Paramalgamation, has finally hit the shelves, as well as Lyle Blackburn's latest work, Sinister Swamps. So I suppose that's my month's reading sorted out, thanks to those two. Don't forget, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram under Mystery Monsters. Search for Mysteries and Monsters on Facebook to join our group, and please subscribe to us on our ever-growing YouTube channel. Right, all ready for an hour and a half of weirdness with the marvellous Paul Sinclair? Yeah, I thought so. Enjoy. Today on Mysteries and Monsters, I'd like to extend a warm welcome back to one of our most popular guests, Paul Sinclair. Paul's trilogy of truth-proof books have shone a light on the variety of strange occurrences in East Yorkshire, so we're delighted to welcome him back to cover more high strangeness. Paul, welcome back, sir. How are we?
I'm good, Paul. Thank you very much for having me back on. Always a pleasure. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, we'll share a few things and hopefully keep people entertained for next hour or so. Well, that's idea anyway, isn't it, mate?
Absolutely, my friend. Well, listen, it's delightful that you want to come back on. I always take that as a great token of credit from yourself and anybody else that wants to come back. So thank you again for fitting me in, because obviously we spoke about 5 months ago. And since then I've had several emails, as I'm sure you're aware, because we talk not outside of this.
We do, yeah.
This situation as well, so we do converse now and again online and keep up to date with each other, so it's always good to get a chance to have a proper chat with you, my friend. So people were very interested last time, and like I say, you're one of those people that people always say, when's he coming back, which I'm kind of sure you're used to these days, because your stories and information and investigations are so compelling, Paul. So what's been going on since the last time we spoke to you? How are things out there in the Bempton area?
Well, as everyone knows, things are not too good at the moment, because we're not, none of us are getting out much, are we? But things are still happening. And literally, they really are. I mean, when we were talking about the animal mutilations and the strangeness that surrounded that eastern North Yorkshire coastline through 17, 18 and into 2019, the livestock got removed just before 2020. So I've not been there that much, Paul. However, I think I've touched on the fact, or on some shows, that there's a chap who lives in the woods close to us. He's lived there for 13 years. And this will make sense, listeners, in a moment. I took him a bit of food last week. Bit of an excuse. It got me out as well, but it were a legitimate thing. We did take him some food. And I managed to have a little walk in the woods at the back of the Danesdyke Woods, not far from where all the weirdness was happening, 17, 18 and 19. And what do I find? Crows with their heads removed. No signs of pellets or gunshot. Unusually, they were supple. And now I do have the photographs. I sound like I'm name dropping here, but I were talking to Linda Moulton Howe about it only yesterday and sent her some photographs. That was last Wednesday. I went again, took him some food yesterday. Same wood, nothing to be seen. Not even the decimated carcasses, as though a fox had scavenged them or something. Yeah. Interestingly, these birds were in trees as well. You know, actually in the trees. And they, for want of a better word, they looked like they'd been positioned there. But as I said, their heads were clean off. And now the downy feather of a crow, I don't want to bore people with this, but obviously everybody believes that they're jet black. But if you look at the under feathers, it's white.
Yeah.
No blood.
Yeah.
No blood. So they were either dead and the heads were removed afterwards. Or there's some other way that this has been done. So just interesting. I mean, it sort of tells you that whatever's happening, whatever was happening, is still there. That the phenomena, if we're going to call it a phenomena, is still present. You know, because I think we've touched on a few things, Paul, didn't we? You know, the potential of the satanic cult.
Yeah.
Well, we know that these people, if they were operating, would be going under hours of darkness and things, but then we can rule out sort of catching crows and beheading crows.
Yeah.
And plus the fact that we're in this lockdown and everybody's alert. The farm folk who are sort of in their properties and on their fields, because they've still got to work, they're noticing strangers and anyone walking about. So it's difficult to say what's happening. I wish I'd got more feet on ground or ability to get out more, but at the moment we've just got to grin and bear it. But yeah, there's lots of things happening. I'm still getting lots of phone calls, lots of emails and different reports. Some are new, some are historic. I got one, I don't think I've spoke about it to you, and I've called it the Crystal UFO because it's from April 24th, 2019, Paul, so it's not that long ago. You know, I mean, because some of them are from 1980s, 1970s.
Yeah.
To me, they're just as valid if witness has got a genuine story to tell, I'll be honest with you.
Absolutely.
But the April one of 19 is a sort of multi-witness account, and I find it really interesting because this guy lives in Bridlington, taking his girlfriend to the Indian restaurant in Bridlington where she worked. So we're talking probably between 6 and 7 in evening, so it's still light. When he gets there, he sort of pulls up outside, and the delivery driver, because they also do takeaways as well as the restaurant, is looking up into the sky. So sort of everybody, common thing, we do the same, we look up and they're looking at this object and saying, you know, what do you think that is? And it's coming across St. John's Street. Now, I realise people listening won't know St. John's Street, maybe not even Bridlington, but Google it, you'll get an idea as a Indian restaurant on there. So he said, all I can describe it as, he said it looked to be about 100 foot deep and 15 to 20 foot round, sort of hexagon-shaped round. And there's a sun shining, and it looked like a giant test tube, is what he said.
Yeah.
Now, it defies description to me.
Mm.
He said the owner of the restaurant came out. He's looking up at it. The customers come out. I'm not going to say a restaurant full. There might have only been one couple in. Mm. The customers came out there looking up at this thing. He said every time it was moving, it was turning. I think he said clockwise. Mm. And as the sun caught it, it was so bright, it was sort of blinding to look at. Mm. But he likened it to almost like liquid glass, because it was constantly looked like it was moving. Mm. But I've never, ever heard a UFO or some kind of object described what the potentially 100 foot deep, 15 to 20 foot round, hexagon shape, turning. And this guy says to me, I was sure the next day this were going to be all over the papers, it were going to be on radio, everybody would hear about it, but nobody said a word. His girlfriend saw it, obviously the people in the restaurant saw it. I've since spoke to the delivery driver to confirm this. So, but nobody said, oh, we've got spectacular things seen under us noses and we miss it. Well, nobody looks up. Yeah. That's one of the problems. We're all that busy getting on with whatever we've got to do. Mm. I mean, there's not really any good points to the lockdown, but it has sort of slowed life down, hasn't it? Yes. There've been people looking at the skies and looking and, contemplating things because we've got so much time to do it. But, I mean, that's not taking it away from the sighting of what we've called the crystal UFO. Yeah. But social media would be all over it. He thought it were going to be all, in the newspaper, the local papers, on the radio. There was nothing, which sort of throws me back now, Paul, to I think probably about 2011, and I went up onto the East Yorkshire Wolds with a guy called Steve Ashbridge, a very good friend. He's sort of been with me from beginning of our trips onto Wolds in 2002 time when we were first out there.
Yeah,
and we took Joe Dormer up with us, who was I think he founded LAPIS, the UFO conferences, and
yes,
and I don't know if you know Joe, but he also ran the Yorkshire UFO Society. So we took Joe up, we picked him up and took him up. And I've got this, which would now be an old, but it were good then. I'd got a Sony VX2100 camcorder on a tripod. So this tells you when people say, why didn't you get a picture? Why didn't you get it on film? You know, and we're supposed to know what we're doing, or we're there on feet on ground hoping we're going to see these things and catch them. So I'm looking towards, from Staxton Wold, we're at the back of the RAF base, and I'm looking towards Driffield. Joe and Steve are looking in the opposite direction. This will tie in partly with the crystal UFO that we've just been speaking about. And in the distance, what happened, from the ground up, and it must have covered at least a mile, Joe and Steve would verify this, and they're on the Facebook, and they're on my friends list if you wanted to ask them. Huge turquoise mushroom of light that you could see through, and there was sort of electric inside it. Well, I started swearing. I'm not going to swear here now. I said, you'll not believe what I've just seen. And I was so disappointed that they'd not seen it, because once again, it was just my word. I should have stuck the camera on, Paul. I should have let it roll.
Yeah.
So I'm telling them, I'm describing what I've just seen, and bosh, it did it again. It blew them away. I mean, honestly, it could have been some natural earth phenomena, or I have no idea what it was. It covered a monstrous area, and it was high. And Steve Ashbridge, he said, that's going to be in papers tomorrow. That we cannot be only people that have seen that. Because it covered, we were looking at it in the distance, and it covered a huge area of land, and it went high from the ground, this huge black mushroom shape. Nobody said a word, never heard a thing about it, nothing. And isn't that the nature of these things? I mean, and I didn't get any film of it. Luckily, the other two saw it, otherwise it would have been forever a day I saw this incredible thing, just this split second or blink of an eye sighting of something. Even if it was some natural earth phenomena, it was spectacular.
Yeah.
And nobody passed comment. I wonder how many other people did see it and have never said a word. How many other people saw what I've termed the crystal UFO on St. John's Avenue and have not said a word? Because that is the nature of things. We'd have been trying to explain this stuff, Paul, with inadequate words. Explaining it to people who, in most instances, are just going to look at you and probably, were you on drugs? Yeah. Drinking. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And once you get that kind of reaction, and that kind of reaction smacked you in the face a few times, you think, I'm not going to bother talking about this, you know?
Mm. Yeah. And
that's the way of things, Paul.
It is. I mean, it's difficult, Paul, because as someone that's had a very strange experience by seeing something in the sky myself 13 years ago, it's remarkable when you experience something, and the same for these people who had that experience outside the restaurant, when you see something so remarkable, I think it baffles you as to why no one else is talking about it. Because when I saw whatever I saw, I don't know what it is, I'm not going to try and pigeonhole it or anything, Paul.
Right.
And I watched it for 30 minutes. And as someone that tries to be balanced and sceptical within reason, you know, I am a very open-minded person, but I'm also, I like to be balanced. I tried everything. I turned lights off. I checked reflections. I assumed it may be something else. And when I'd got to that point, I was so convinced, I thought that the only thing I must have possibly seen was a comet or a meteor, to the point that I emailed the British Meteorological Society and explained it. They came back to me, asked me for details, told them what I'd seen, and they said, well, you haven't seen a meteor or a comet because it was moving too slowly. And I, to this day, cannot comprehend what it was. I know what it wasn't.
Yeah.
But it was the strangest thing. And it took me about 15 minutes of watching it, Paul, and then I suddenly thought, oh, where's my mobile? And I started filming it.
Yeah.
It's the only mobile phone I've ever lost. Ever. In 25 years, I've never lost a phone, never brought one. That one, with the footage on, which didn't do it justice, to be honest. It just looked like a white ball in the sky at 2 in the morning. But it was just so baffling. So I understand exactly where you're coming from in regards to when you see these phenomena. Like I say, it took me 15 minutes to think, hang on a minute, where's my phone?
Yeah. Well, you know, it is true. Earlier, it was earlier this year, myself, Lee Haywood, two lads from Scarborough, Chris Wright and Steve, I forgot Steve's surname, but it slips me, and two other guys came through to Bempton, and we got like a display of the light forms. Everybody had got cameras. Steve and Chris had only got phone cameras, but they're still good. But we got like these lights intermittently switching on and off over the sea for 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we'd been up prior to that for 6 months, and there'd been, well, not 6 months, but months, and there'd been very little happening. Yeah. But the only person, and that doesn't mean because I'm good, that got some footage was me.
Mm.
Only because I were willing to stand there with my hands dropping off. It were absolutely freezing.
Yep.
You know, but you're also, that's another thing you also face, because when you're up there, you know, with lack of funds, you can't have a camera running 24/7 because, you know, I suppose you could buy 6 or 8 batteries and do it, but then you're also, it's wear and tear on the camera.
Yeah.
You know, I've not got loads of money. I think I spend a couple of grand on the camera, and I don't want to buy another one, but you can pay absolute thousands. I mean, we could do with some funding. I'm not inting people. You know, but it's just...
No, I know.
It's difficult because, you know, we pour everything into it, and we get people saying, have you tried infrared? Well, yeah, we have. Do you use night vision goggles? They're incredible, the night vision goggles that I've been using. You know, have we got infrared torches, and have we got Geiger counters? We've hit it and used everything on it. And, we it's not for the want of trying, but there's 24 hours in a day and 7 days a week, and I, as one man, can't be there all that time. But I sound like I'm moaning there, people, so I do apologise. So that little sighting, and then I can throw another one in now, and we've called it the Caravel Light. I'm saying we, as though I've got a second person here, listeners. I haven't. And the Caravel is a cafe come public house at North Landing at Flamborough. Some people might be familiar with it. It's been there years. Mm. And this guy has sent me the report. I've spoken to him, and he sent me this report from 37 years ago, 1983. And he was 10 years old at the time. And him, his mum and dad, went and parked in the car park at the top of Flamborough Head, and they wanted to look at the sea. That was the idea. They'd parked up to sort of view the sea. And his dad went into the pub and bought himself a pint of beer, his wife a drink, and I don't know, Pop and Chris Foot Boy. Mm. He said, and as he walked to the pub, he noticed that the light on the big display saying Caravel, the cafe, was flashing intermittently, a fault, on, off, on, off, stay on for 10 seconds, go off for 10, come back on. There were no regularity to it. He said there was people inside the public house, and there were no, it weren't a general electric fault. That's what I'm saying. Everything was lit up in there as normal. So it's about 8 a.m. and it's 8 p.m., should I say, and it's dark. And they sat there and they look out to sea, and above the sea, what did they observe but an orange sphere of light that looked about the size of a football. He said, it's a couple of miles out, and they're looking at this, can't work out what it is. Mum, dad, son, sat inside car trying to decipher it. And then he must have looked back at the light and said, because the orange sphere was going on and off. Mm. And when he looked at the light, it went off for 10 seconds. When the light went off for 10 seconds, ah. When the light came on, the orange sphere came on. If the light flashed three times, the orange sphere flashed three times. Now, the absolutely adamant, we know we've only got these people's word, mm-hmm. that this thing was above the water, not on the surface of the water, not a boat flashing out at sea, I don't know, for whatever reason, and why would a faulty light be something to flash at anyway? Yep. So we've got an orange sphere is described, and he's not fitted it to the light forms that we're talking about to suit me. He's sort of described it to a T and looked at what the pictures and the images we've put out and said, that's what it looked like. But this orange sphere, it was so random, it might flash for 5 seconds, the light stopped, it stopped. We just couldn't work it out. But that kind of makes me think, because it was stationary, it was still there when they left, and it was still flashing with the light when they left. And they weren't just there for 10 minutes. And I've said, like, there's some kind of intelligence, some kind of an awareness to these lights, hence the term that I sort of tried to coin about in 2002 with ILF UFO website, ILF meaning intelligent light forms, because I did think there were an awareness to them then on East Yorkshire Wolds. And I'm not the first person to think there's an awareness to them, Paul. I'm not trying to claim that. But it kind of makes you think, doesn't it? You know, I mean, he said it were almost like Morse code, but this thing were independent of the sea, up in the air. He said we could see boats further out on the horizon. Mm. So, you know, it clearly weren't a boat. But, you know, I've noted, Paul, that when the rock anglers have got a fishing match on, and they light up on the cliff tops, tilly lamps and powerful sort of Cree LEDs, these lights show. Mm. How do I know that? Because I get the rock anglers contacting me and saying, we've got a weird display of orange lights that are coming on in multiples of twos, threes, fours and fives, switching off, appearing in different parts of the sky. But I've noted that it's happening when there's people there lighting up the cliff tops. Because bear in mind, most days of the year after dark, year in, year out, nobody's on those cliffs. They're so remote. In the daytime, you've got bird watchers from the RSPB, you know, the nature reserve. Yep. But after dark, nobody wants to be up there. So the eyes and ears, shall we say, are the rock anglers and the men who fish the sea, the trawlermen. Yeah. And they report that they see these things. But I find it intriguing that, you know, Penny didn't drop straight away. I mean, we've been up there when there's been fishing matches and these lights show. But we can then go up there for a month, nobody up there, and you see nothing. You go up there, there's a fishing match, and wow, these lights are showing. It's not every time. There's other instances, Paul, where you can take somebody new up and you get a display.
Yeah.
It's almost like the phenomena's showing off.
Yeah.
I took a guy up, a very good friend called Lee Hayward. He'll probably get to listen to this. And if anybody is listening, is on Facebook and they're friends with me or they want to be, and you want to confirm the story, find Lee Hayward. He's a real articulate guy, really switched on. Lee was with us the night when we didn't get photographs, and I got that bit of film. But this particular night, I think it was September 19, it was September 16th or something like that. I can't remember the exact date.
Yeah.
It was me and Lee on the cliff tops. Well, first of all, we drove along Cliff Lane. Lee had come. He made no bones about it. He'd come to disprove what I were looking at.
Yeah.
He's got a vast knowledge of military aircraft, should we say, and is a really genned-up guy. Mm. He knew exactly what was in the air. He knew exactly what boats were out on the horizon. He'd come to disprove it. So as we're driving along Cliff Lane...
Paul, somebody's listening.
Listen, it's all good. So we're driving along Cliff Lane, and to my right, I sort of turned to my right and I says, look at that. Orange sphere lights up in the sky. He goes, what's that? I says, well, you tell me. I said, you're the aviation expert. He says, well, I don't know. And it just switched off as quick as it switched on. We unloaded the gear, camera equipment and what have you, and it sounds like there's a lot, but there's only a couple of tripods and two bags. And off we go down to the cliff face, set it up. We've not been there long. Light appears over the sea. Need to stress, anybody who's not heard me talk about these things before, they're not flying from anywhere, people. These things just appear. They switch on. And you're looking at them for a few seconds and they switch off. Or they become two, or they become three, and in some instances, six. And then they'll switch off and appear in a different part of the sky. They don't fly away. Mm. Or if they do, they're so fast that we can't see it, the process, should we say. Yeah. So I couldn't, by the time I'd got camera switched on, it had gone. So Lee had noted the time. He did a brilliant write-up for me, actually, a few days later. And we left it, I don't know, we'll say 15 minutes past. Another one lit up, similar place. And then one at the side of it. You put the camera on, they've gone. So this continued to happen. Total silence as well, people. Nothing... no noise at all. And they're a lot bigger. If you can picture the Venus, how big and bright it is, well, they're a bit bigger than that, but they're a bit bright, vibrant orange. Mm. And they're not flying from anywhere. They're not slowly descending on wind. They're not flares. And, you know, because we've always got people who've never been there, who are experts and are quick to tell me what they are. And I've spent years up there and I still don't know what they are. So... with that in mind, I've got camera ready and I'm thinking these things are going to show. I'm going to get this fired up and sort of get some footage of them. I just turned and looked inland and I said, Lee, wow, look at this. And in the field about 400 yards away, there's three in a pyramid shape on, you know, top circle and then two below. Very close, 400 yards away. Huge orange glow around them that's lighting the field up. Now, these are close. I got the camera turned round, put it on, and they're imploding as I'm trying to get camera on them. And they've literally gone. Well, Lee's sold now. The guy who came to disprove it, he's absolutely sold. He's been up there with me so many times now because he's just got no explanation for what he saw. I mean, 400 yards away and totally silent. Yeah, there's so many. It's a multi-phenomena area. I don't know, probably 6 weeks ago, Bob Brown, who comes out with me quite often, and one of my daughters who'd been staying with us, Gemma, she decided she wanted to come out with us this night.
Yep.
And we get up to the cliff tops. Don't let me just carry on, Paul, if you've got a question to ask.
No, carry on, sir. You're all right. Don't worry, I'll jump in when I feel.
Yeah, well, we gets up to the cliff tops and we go to one of these stands and I set a tripod up and a camera. And I've got a really powerful torch and Bob's got same torch, actually. And I let Gemma have it and she's sort of sweeping it about in the field behind me, put it on and just had a look. Mm. It's really dark night and I'm trying to set camera up out over the sea. So I'm probably about 20 feet away from these two. And I heard Gemma say to Bob, what's that in field, Bob? So he must have looked. I could hear him, but I went, he says, I think it's a sign on a fence post. I says, oh, all right, and turned the torch off. Yeah. Then Bob went, hold on a minute, there ain't no fence post there. and then put his torch on it. Now, they both say that they saw a luminous white square of light. So it's not conforming to UFO or something, I don't know, ghostly apparition. It's square, luminous square of light that... let's describe it as the square that about the size what you'd see a runner in a marathon, you know, the little sticker they have on the back.
Yeah.
And they both saw it drop to the ground and disappear. Now, it sort of defies description what we're finding and what we're looking at up there. I were up there last year with a police officer. He picked me up and we drove up to Bempton, parked up. We were going to spend the full night up there. There's very few people I'll spend a night up there with, simply because I'm spending I keep unhealthy amount of time. I always say that, but it's true up there anyway. Yeah. But when this guy wants to go, I do. I like his company, and he's had this sighting, which we'll I think we might have touched on it last time. So we'll, but regardless, as we're walking down and we're looking over towards the old RAF base, a square of light lit up in the sky above it, and big. No sound. He swore this time. He went, wow, do that again. And we both stood there, sort of jaws dropped. We spent the rest of the night in various places on those cliffs, and nothing happened. That gave us whatever it was. We be a natural phenomenon, and it was just pure coincidence, or be it something that's sort of playing with us. That gave us a little taste of it within 5 minutes of leaving the RSPB car park. Yeah. It really. It's expect the unexpected. That's about all I can say. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, Paul. I mean, it is. I mean, one of the most compelling things about all this is as you've alluded to there, Paul. It doesn't happen all the time. You can go weeks without seeing anything, and then something completely out of the blue just occurs, and then it seems to think, right, well, I've just made my presence known. I'm off again now. And then that's it. It just seemed to disappear. And it's intriguing because I know, you know, anybody who doesn't live near the coast or has no experience of living near the coast will probably always, like you said, Paul, will brush it under the carpet, say, oh, yeah, it's probably a boat or anything.
Yeah.
I've lived near the coast for about 3 years when I was younger down south. And I used to love on a night sitting on the beach in the dark, sitting there just watching the ships coming in and out. On the south coast, beautiful. I used to find it so relaxing, and you eventually get used to how things work, and you can see the boats bobbing, and you can gauge their movements. So whenever you see anything that sticks out like a sore thumb, you've got to give it the credence it deserves, because it doesn't look like everything else, you know. And as you mentioned there, you sometimes have that point of reference of a ship or a boat on the horizon or in the foreground. So you can make the presumption that of where these objects are. And it baffles me that there clearly seems to be a level of intelligence here that seems to enjoy teasing yourself.
It's teasing, but there's also, I believe, there's moods to the place because... Mm. I mean, I were up there with Steve Ashbridge just before lockdown, and we're not brave people. I mean, I've spent a lot of time up there on my own, and I don't think I'm brave. I'm maybe stupid, but you know. But what I'm saying is, Steve very rarely says it feels strange. It feels really, really off. Mm. But he did this particular night. He did, and it felt real, and you could feel it. Like a, I don't know. Maybe we're living off each other's fear, but you could feel an electricity almost in the air. And that is what the paratrooper, you know, on February the 7th, 2019, said that they felt. I think we covered this story before, Paul,
yes.
Didn't we?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
To detail we and bore people. But he said when they set off along that cliff path, everything felt static. Yeah. He said to me, and we speak quite regular, we've become quite good friends due to this. I think because he's searching for somebody to talk to. And he said, if ever you're there and you feel like that, he says, get the hell out of there. He says, because he says, I saw something from a nightmare. And in his words, he said, I've done Iraq. I've done Bogside in Belfast. He says, but I have never experienced fear like what I saw on them cliff tops at Bempton. Yeah. But did I talk about the sighting from January 20th, 2020 this year?
No.
Do you want me to touch on that?
Please.
What's interesting here, Paul, is that the three-para, Rob, he saw it, I think it was the 7th of February in 2019, a couple visiting Flamborough for the weekend, 31st of January 2020, so we've got a year and 7 days later, 2 miles away from where Rob saw this alleged creature, they arrive at Flamborough at their cottage, which they're renting for the weekend, and decide to go on foot down to North Landing, approximately where that Carvel car park is, you know, where this guy, as a young boy, saw the light flashing. And they walk to the top of the car park. Now, people can Google this if they wanted to. You know, Flamborough Head, North Landing car park. Mm-hmm. They walked up to the top, and then they looked over the top, and there's a ravine. It's called Holmes's Gut, which is interesting because the surname of the lady who's got the report is spelt exactly the same. We know that's just a coincidence, but it's called Holmes's Gut. That's what local people call this ravine.
Yeah.
So they walk down into the ravine. And they said everything felt weird. We suddenly felt very frightened. It was just strange. So we said, right, we're not hanging about here. Bearing in mind, people, there's no street lights. Because I've said there's a public house, like a cafe cum public house at the top of North Landing. That was closed.
Mm.
That's only open out at summer season.
Yep.
And there's nothing else. So we're in complete darkness here. And they come back up the steps. And there's what you've got is some outcrops of rocks. I don't know whether it's everywhere in UK, but in eastern North Yorkshire, they call them nabs.
Mm.
It's a nab. So, and they're looking out, and it's a moonlit night, so they can see everything clearly. Now, they'd got an infrared camera without a card in it. They'd got a good JVC camera, because I had a look at it the next day. You know, I saw it, should I say. I don't mean let me have a look. a decent sort of handheld camera, DSLR, and the phones. And they'd gone down equipped with this gear. The infrared camera, I think, just to look at the surroundings. But anyway, they're looking at this nab, and they stood there temporarily before they went down into this little ravine, and they said, look at that. And they're looking, and on the end of it, and it's only about 30 foot wide, and it's sort of cambered, it's rounded. If you put a milk bottle on its side, round one, it's like that.
Yeah.
He says, we're looking at this huge statue. And now this guy's called Lee. Lee says, I'm 6 foot tall. We went through this. We spoke to him face to face. We met him the next morning, myself and Bob Brown, and they walked to the location with me. They were reluctant to go on film, but they've since said they will, and they're coming back. So we're gonna sort of film them telling us about this. He says, there's a huge statue of a dog on Ednacliff Cliff. I said, well, it weren't there before. We're sure it weren't. It weren't there 10 minutes since. They're questioning themselves. They're sort of thinking, we've never been before. Perhaps we've just missed it, but how could we have? It sat down. He says it was as tall as me, sat in, you know, as in the position a dog sits.
Yeah.
Unusually, he said, and they both commented on this. That's why I've called this story, come out with weirdest things, people, the Starlight Express. She says, have you ever seen the Starlight Express? And I said, well, I haven't. I've looked since. She says, well, they're going around on roller skates, and they've got extra, like, extensions on their arms. They look really weird with skates on their hands.
Mm.
The arms on this thing just look too big, almost like you'd get a gorilla and its arms seem to have to come out to the side because they're too big for its body.
Yeah.
And she said, we're looking at it, and she said, we've got a Rottweiler, which they didn't have with them, but she said, back of its head and shoulders looked similar. She said, but the next thing, it moves. Oh, they got the cameras on it. They couldn't see it with the infrared. They just could not see this thing with the infrared camera. They could see the cliffs, the white of the Flamborough cliffs. They could see the contour of the nab, but they couldn't see this thing. Lee hears it growl, a low guttural growl. She didn't hear it, but he said that's what he heard. It lowered down and dropped onto all fours, and on the camber of the roll of the land, it went to the opposite side, and they could see it on all fours moving along. Now, they were frightened, and they sort of made their way back on foot to their cottage. They jumped back in the car when they got there and drove back up with headlights on, but there was nothing there. They didn't want to hang around just as two people on foot because it frightened them. Then what they did, they sort of went on their social media or their tablets, internet, and started typing things in and found my name. And I was still watching TV, and they messaged me after midnight that night to tell me what they'd seen. And I got in touch with them. And as I say, me and Bob met them the next day. Absolutely brilliant sighting, you know?
Yeah.
And I do find it interesting, more so, that the paratrooper also had a sighting a year and 7 days previous, within 2 miles. Now, these people don't know each other. You know, we've got the para who lives at one end of the country, and we've got these people, good, responsible jobs.
Yep.
No reason to come out with a story like this. And, well, they have done, and they're claiming that they've seen it. So I just find all these things, you know, I mean, I've said it 1,000 times, I never, ever expected to be researching cryptids.
Yeah.
My research, Paul, was simply searching for answers for the things that had happened to me during childhood and, you know, throughout my life.
Yeah.
And that's why I became so entrenched in it. So I never thought for one second I was going to get involved in the cryptid research. But for me, if you've got what you perceive as credible witnesses coming forward saying they've seen these things, then we've got to take them seriously. I do anyway. I mean, I don't, I do get stories, you know, where some people are telling me things, and I'm very polite, and we'll have a look at that, and I don't. I never follow it up.
Yes.
It's clear that somebody's seen a light going through the sky, and it's flared up and then dimmed down. They've seen an iridium flare, or they show me a picture of an animal in a field, and then you look at the grass at side of the animal, and you get the time of year and things, and you think that grass was probably about 8 inch high. That's an house cat.
Yeah.
I don't mean I get it right every time, but I do try and rule things out. But some of these stories I just find incredible.
Absolutely. I mean, that alone, Paul, says to me that these people had clearly had an experience that scared them, quite clearly, because if you then are that shaken by something that you can't comprehend and you can't explain, added to that oppressive static feeling, and I think anybody who's ever experienced that knows exactly what you mean. It's almost as if you can smell, it's like when a lightning storm comes, you can smell it coming. Do you know what I mean?
You can taste the air.
Yeah.
And I don't know if anybody's ever done this, but if you put your tongue on one of them batteries with two prongs on, you've probably not done it.
Not for a long time.
I've got kids that used to do that, but that me taste too. You get in your mouth, that's it. It's that electrical taste. It's that strange taste. But I'm just showing how sensible I am there, putting my tongue on batteries, aren't I?
We've all done it, Paul. Anybody who says they haven't's not lived.
Yeah, so you know, these sightings are just don't stop coming in. There's an interesting one from January 2020. I don't know how much time we've got, Paul.
Well, I'm all right if you are, sir. Carry on.
Yeah, well, you know, this involves an angler on the beach at Hornsey. So we're looking at 15 miles away from where I'm sat now. Mm. So 18 miles away from Bempton and Flamborough. So he's on the beach, night fishing. This is an interesting story. This is approximately 10 past 12 at night. He said it was an hour before high tide. He did give me a date, but it slips me mind just at this moment. But I know it was January 2020, and he said it was an hour before high tide, and the absolutely weather conditions were horrendous. The sea's roaring. We're 1 hour before high, and it's already up to where high tide usually is.
Yeah.
So he moved off the beach and got behind a small sea defence. Mm. He's got his rod there, his fish, and he's tucked down behind this little wall, sheltering. And he lived 5 minutes from home. His dad took him. His dad came and picked him up. He still lives at home, should I say. Spoke to him quite regular. He said he's watching. He knows it's 10 past 12-ish. And he just looks down the beach to his left. And there's a figure walking along the shore. Now, bearing in mind conditions, it's horrendous. It shouldn't have been there. He said, if it was a person, and he says, and it's a big if, it had to be a female. He said, or even a child. He said, it were no more than 5 foot tall. Mm. Remember, hour, you know, 12:10. And it was very, very slim. And I said, well, if it were a female, did you discern hips and breasts or anything, you know? He said, no. He said, it was straight up and straight down. He said, but so slim, so wafer thin. Mm. He said, it was all black. Everything on this person or being was black. Mm. He said, even at 12:10 at night, he said, I should have been able to discern some shade of face or something, he says, but it were almost as though every part of it were in a black suit. Yeah. He said it was walking military fashion with its legs. You know, its legs were moving, but its arms weren't moving at all. They were just splayed out to the sides. So I'm watching this thing, trying to work out what I'm actually looking at. And he said, and at one point, and I don't know whether he got up to show himself to this thing walking up beach or whether he got cramp, but he said, I stood up. He said it was about 50 foot away from me. He says, and as soon as I stood up, it stopped. He said, and that my immediate thought was that this thing, because he doesn't think it were a human, he don't think anybody could be so slim and walking at that hour when the sea's smashing the beach. He said, this thing, he said, I instantly thought it said, oh, it just looked and thought, oh, and a swear word, a bleep, I've been seen.
Yeah.
He said, and within 5 to 7 seconds, it sort of pixelated and vanished in front of my eyes. And now he said, I was terrified, absolutely terrified. I grabbed my rod. I'm not going to say he cut the line. I don't know what I got my gear together. He said, I'd got a small filleting knife in my hand. I'm ringing my dad.
Yep.
Come and pick me up. He says, I'm pretty hysterical on phone. He says, and he was there for me within 5 minutes. He says, I felt like it was watching me. Now, that could be paranoia, Paul. I do realise that. He says, but I've got my gear together. I've got home. He says, I'd be being generous if I said that it was 15 minutes from ringing my dad, from seeing it to ringing my dad to getting home, because he literally comes straight out for me. Now, if it was 12:10 that I tied, and he will give him a few minutes, and then he looked down the beach and saw it. Mm. He should have been home for 12:30, and that's been very generous. It were 1:37 when he got in. So he's also missing time. Now, He were very, very open, this guy, and he wanted me to use his name and everything, and it's me being extra careful that I didn't, because I contacted the paper, the Hornsey and Holderness Gazette, and told them about this, and I put them in touch with this guy, and they ran a story on him. I asked them to change his name, because I know what's going to happen. I know the ridicule factor, and so they've done that. They've done this story, but I wanted the story in the paper because I thought, well, he might not be the only person to experience this.
Yeah.
Well, you won't believe it. Rock angler contacts me. Yeah. I fished that beach. What did he say? Man and boy. And sometimes you're fishing it, and when there's shingle on the beach, and you it's just like we were talking about earlier. You know your surroundings. You know what's there and what isn't there. You know when somebody's walking towards you. Footsteps, walking towards me. You're looking, you can hear footsteps. I'm not saying you see shingle moving. Nothing there. I did a bit of investigating and went speaking to some anglers on the beach. I've done it several times. Bumped into one guy who'd come for the day from Leeds, but a former Hornsey resident, but he'd lived in Leeds now for the last 10 years, so probably 80 miles away. But he'd come for the day fishing. And I said, did you read the article in the Hornsey Gazette? And he said he hadn't, and I told him what had happened. He said, it doesn't surprise me. He says, I was here as a young boy digging for bait, three of us, dark. He said, low tide and it were dark, and we're not talking about midnight, but it were dark. He said, and one of my friends screamed out in sort of pain. You know when you sort of push somebody at the back of the leg, back of the knee, and the leg gives way?
Yep.
He said, and he screamed out in pain. He says, we all turned round. He says, and there's a black shape running away and vanishing as it's running. So there's another angler I've spoken to. claims that he's seen some black figure walking up the beach that's vanished in front of him. The difference here, and I'm not going to dress it up to make story sound any better, but I could say a black figure and just end it. Mm. But he said it was huge. He said it were about 7 foot tall, which is the complete opposite of what this young angler's told us. But, you know, just by digging, just by getting one story, I've probably collected, well, I have, there's four now, there's three solid ones, and there's another one that I've got to do a bit more work on and follow up. But what, once again, what it's revealed, Paul, is the location, Hornsey. And this story is unique to that beach on Hornsey. Location is key. And it really is. It doesn't mean that these things don't happen in other parts of the country and other parts of the world, but certain locations are synonymous for certain things. There's Cannock Chase and the werewolves.
Yeah.
You know, Flixton and the stories of the Flixton werewolf. It's, you know, Bray Road, in the Beast of Bray Road and the werewolves. They become... You can't have so many people all independent of one another claiming that they've seen a similar thing if there is not a grain of truth attached to it.
Yeah, very true. I mean, I know I'm no expert at the East Coast. I've been there enough, Paul, to know, you know, like I touched on earlier, I've lived on the coast. I know how quickly things can change. And I once went to the East Coast for a weekend with my brother and a couple of friends golfing. And in one round of golf, we got four seasons in about 3 hours. So I know how quickly it could change. So I've got enough respect of the coast and the sea to know that people having a quiet stroll late at night at high tide is suicide, essentially.
It's just a no-go. But then you've also got the fact that the main ingredient to the story is... It vanished in front of his eyes. We've got something with the ability to render itself invisible when it's been seen. He says, because he honestly thought, he said, as soon as I stood up, it stopped. He says, and I just thought, it's just looked and thought, oh, bleep, I've been seen and vanished. Yeah. And, you know, it really is. It's incredible. But there's so many sightings. I mean, in February of this year at Caton, which is... opposite side of Flixton on the cars on that lake bed.
Yep.
There's a guy who's got a property right on the edge. Well, him and his wife, actually. I spoke to him in the past about a big cat sighting years ago. But he tells me they've no curtains up at their windows because there's nobody overlooking them.
Yeah.
And they're only looking onto what's known as the cars, the old lake bed. And he gets up to use toilet at night and comes back to bed, so he's still awake, looking out of his window. He's got two windows in his bedroom, and one of them looks onto Staxton Wold, the RAF base. Mm. And the other one, he can see Bempton Cliffs. He's a lucky guy. Well, Speeton Cliffs.
Yeah.
So he's looking, and he's obviously familiar with everything. They've lived there a lot of years. I've been to property. I've stood where he claims he saw this. Said, and there's a sphere of red light above the base. And I'm thinking, well, that's not an aircraft. It's not moving. Yeah. So it just remains stationary for a while. Not talking hours or anything, but and then it sets off moving and it travels in his direction. It's coming across in a straight line across the sky as though it's controlled. He sees it pass and loses sight of it and then captures it in the other window. And it stops over the sea at Speeton, or he says it does. And he's watching this from bed. And he said, with that, and this is early hours of morning, when it stopped, it instantly became 10, not 8 or 6, 10. 10 spheres of equally sized, equally spaced red light that dropped into sea. Now, this is above military base originally. Is it some military technology that they're testing? It doesn't sound like a flare. I mean, that's not going to go in a straight line out to sea. Well, it's not going to stop over at base, first of all. Mm. We're talking, let's do the distance. We're talking it's travelled 11 miles
yeah.
in a straight line. 11 miles approximately from Staxton Wold as the crow flies to Speeton. And so it's done an 11-mile journey. I didn't even get the time off him. 11-mile journey, stopped over the sea, remained there, stationary, then turned into 10, and then dropped into the sea. No smoke, all moving at the same pace until they've gone below the cliffs and they've vanished. Now that's occurring. That's in early hours at morning in February of 2020. I don't know what we've got that can do that, but then again, I'm no sort of military expert, and it's possible that it was some kind of military, I don't know, technology. It could be. We can't turn everything into a complete unknown, Paul. Mm. That's the danger that we all do as sort of unexplained paranormal stroke investigators, and a lot of it's going to have an explanation. Yeah. I've not got one foot cryptids, but I really haven't. It's just got me beat. These cryptid type sightings have got me beat, but then again, lots of things get me beat.
I mean, to be honest, Paul, I'd be interested in finding out. As we touch on, there's only one thing that really gives me the heebie-jeebies, and always has done as a lover of horror and the weird and wonderful, and that's always been werewolves.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is there some kind of psychological response that these people have a deep-seated fear that they may not even be thinking of at these times when they're in this location, Paul, and it picks up on that fear and manifests itself as what would scare them? Now, I was going to say, because it wouldn't be the first time where we've had a kind of emotional reaction creating a kind of fear response in someone. So I would be interested in understanding if these people had a fear of strange things, and is it reacting to their deep inset fears that they may have locked away somewhere in their head, Paul, that they may not even be thinking about it, but they just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time to allow this to tap into that.
Do you know, I've thought about this quite a lot in connection with the East Yorkshire coastline and the things that we've been seeing. And just to jump from that briefly, you know, you've got some ufologists who believe that these things are nuts and bolts type craft. Mm. And these people tend to see nuts and bolts type craft. Yep. I'm not saying in all instances. I'm open enough to think, well, let's just throw it open because it may be anything, because anything's possible. Mm. But you know, I've talked about, you know, Bempton, and said, is it almost like, it's almost like a hive mind. Mm. And it could be anything to any, and present as anything. It's the phenomena you've just touched on, the phenomena. I'm not saying this is what's happening, but yeah, if you've got something of such great intelligence and you're thinking of cryptids and you're concentrating on that kind of thing, then these things are appearing, these things are being seen to your eyes. And if you're looking for the light forms, the spheres of light, then these things are being seen. Please don't associate me with going down that road. These are just theories and throwing them out, and you know, it's almost like the phenomena itself is looking at us through one-way glass, like somebody would do observing a prisoner. And but the only difference is the phenomena has the ability to step through the glass into our sphere of existence and back, and it's sort of knowing what we want to see and giving us a taste of it. As I say, the hive mind. I talked about it to Andrew Collins, and that he were asking me what my views were. If you hear people talking about these people, and Paul Sinclair ain't copied it, by the way. No, it's true. And, you know, because I know there's going to be a documentary out shortly that's going to cover Flixton and Starcar and that kind of area, and about the shamanic practice at Starcar, and the theory that the shaman at Starcar have somehow evoked the werewolf and things like that. Well, if you ever wonder where they got these ideas from and this research from, you'll know it's me. But there you go. So I don't know. I mean, I'm rambling there a bit, people. I do apologise.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to say. There's so many different variants and variations of these cryptids as well. Yeah. Yeah. There's a guy jumping in Caton again, staying in Caton on a road called West Garth in 2011, when the properties were just being built and it was a huge field just with foundations in at the time.
Yeah.
This is on the edge of the cars, on the edge of the ancient lake bed. And this guy and his wife were driving home, and he caught it from corner of his eye. It came down the side of a bungalow, so a property.
Yeah.
Creature, and he said in one leap it sent to jump to front of the garden, and in another leap it were in middle at road, and they both saw this thing.
Mm.
And for one, it didn't resemble a werewolf as such. He said if anything, he said it looked like what he would perceive a demon would look like. He said, but it were wrong. He said everything about it were wrong. And I mean, we might have touched on this one last time we spoke, actually. Mm. He said because his joints were wrong, it sort of back to front. That like hocks, and if it had fur, it was that thin and tight. It was almost like a silver white fur. He says because it was so sinuous and muscular that you could discern all its muscles. So he doesn't even know if it had fur. But then you've got in Flixton again and around Flixton, you've got people talking about this huge biped dog type creature that's covered in fur. Mm. So which is complete contrast to what other people are seeing. You know, there's two girls and, well, young women coming home from a works, they call it a works do. Mm. And they're keen to stress that they weren't drunk. She were driving. And she said, my sister only had a glass of wine with a meal. And not far from where this guy saw this creature, not far from where other people have seen things, the road between Filey and Flixton, mm. this thing came down the field. Well, they assume it did, the sloping field, because it landed in the middle of the road. And she described very similar to what the guy in Caton described. So the similarities, they don't know each other. Mm. I mean, anybody who wants to find that thread, I got the story because there's a pub in Flixton called the Foxhound.
Mm.
And before the lockdown, wonderful food, can't praise it enough, but somebody found some links to the Flixton Werewolf and put it on their website.
Mm.
And lo and behold, somebody said, that's what you saw. And then people, I watched the thread grow,
yeah.
And they were talking about it. So I contacted these people and I got to speak to them. So, you know, we've got contrasting images of what this creature is, which I find strange. Mm-hmm. We've got the guy with the high profile job on the company board of directors traveling home from Scarborough.
Mm.
Through Flixton to a place called Foxholes and said it was running at the side of his car. I mean, I spoke to this guy, absolutely terrified. He was in a Jaguar motor car.
Yeah.
You know, I think we touched on it before. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, I don't particularly think I'm ever going to get to the bottom of it. It's not going to stop me searching.
Mm.
But anybody listening who's got a story to tell, please share it.
Absolutely. I mean, I find these stories quite perplexing, Paul, even as someone, you know, as you've humbly said, you know, cryptids aren't your thing, whereas most people who listen to the show will probably think they are mine.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I find that really interesting because essentially we don't have a history of werewolves in this country at all. It's mostly a European tradition, primarily Germany, France, Austria, Switzerland, that kind of area. But we do have in this country a very well established from Cornwall to Scotland. And everywhere in between, we have legendary stories of large black dogs. As we call them in Yorkshire, bargasts.
But yeah, the bargast, the shucks.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Most people know them shucks or padfoots, I think, some of the names. I mean, there's countless names for them, Paul.
Yeah.
And yet, the old folklore and early stories of these creatures essentially are giant dogs, often with flaming eyes, who are either a portent of doom or a portent of good fortune, depending on the person's experience after the event.
Yeah.
And yet that doesn't seem to match, because what they're describing is bipedal most of the time, whereas the history of shucks in this country, these are essentially giant dogs.
Yeah.
So I just find it perplexing because, like I say, you know, there are, as you touched on, Flixton's probably one of the most famous. You mentioned Cannock Chase. There's a couple of stories from Scotland from sort of the 17th, 18th, which are a bit more witchcraft linked than anything. And yet, it doesn't seem to match the folklore. So once again, and I know there will be direct parallels. I mean, made with certain other cultures and other countries with histories of native legends and things, and you know, and I'm loath to use the term skinwalker because we simply do not have a history of these creatures at all. It's not something that we're aware of.
Well, do you know, after speaking with Linda last night, she said, have you got a history of werewolf type creatures in the UK? I says, I think we've probably got one of the oldest werewolf accounts or in the world with the Flixton werewolf. Mm. You know, it depends how you want to read the literature. But when you've got literature from 937 AD, yeah, saying that the refuge was built to protect travellers from an infestation of savage beasts, mm, and talk of the wolves being different in that they preferred the blood of the victim to the meat, and, you know, it's interesting. And then you've got the actual villager name, which used to be called Wolfland, yeah, and then you've got a few miles away, I know I've touched on all this before, but Hunmanby, farmstead of the Houndman. You know, we have got, I wouldn't say lots of cryptid type stories, but we it does go back quite a long way. Mm. And then you've got the shape-shifting element of it, because the people at Starkar, according to the archaeologists who excavated Starkar, did believe that the people who settled there were practicing shamanism, mm, if that's the correct term for it. And in which case, we're going back 11,000 years. We're going back to sort of just after the, well, it's Mesolithic, isn't it? So yeah, we're going back 11,000 years to people who were practicing ritualistic magic back then. Now, and I did sort of postulate on the idea years ago, what if they've evolved and created something? What if it's a thought form?
Yeah.
I mean, we shouldn't throw anything away. What if the nuts and bolts ufologists to see nuts and bolts UFOs, because that's what they're concentrating on. Mm. What if the phenomena is real? And you touched on this earlier. What if it's real? But what if it is an all-encompassing phenomena, a hive mind that could be anything? Now, there's a thought, you know?
Absolutely. And I think it's very interesting because, like I say, when you come to the realms of strange creatures and people of unusual shapes in strange scenarios,
yeah,
it defies standard explanation. So you have to then open your mind to the potential that this might be working on some kind of different level.
Oh yeah, without a doubt, it's got to be. It's not on any level that we perceive, is it? Without a doubt, I mean, it's working. They are the effects that we're feeling when we, so at most times when we're seeing these things, it actually affects the way we feel sometimes before we've even seen it, which sort of suggests to me that it potentially could be helping or releasing chemicals within our body. It might be doing it with knowledge.
Yeah.
That releasing fear chemicals to make us feel like that to start with. Because how are we feeling fear in some instances before we actually perceive that there's something to be fearful of? So have these things got the ability? Are they so far advanced that they can actually induce these chemical reactions in our bodies and make us release chemicals? I mean, I know we didn't set off talking about any of this, but they're all things that have gone through my mind, and when I'm trying to sort of solve these puzzles, which, quite honestly, people, I never solve.
Well, that is the great thing about it, Paul. It is such a conundrum, because it like you say, it doesn't happen very often. It seems to affect different people in different ways. People who have no experience or knowledge of the area have extremely frightening experience that changed their perception of the world around them as well, I would suggest, Paul, because when you're confronted with something that you cannot explain through science or physics or a basic understanding of even things like reflections in the sky, where you can sometimes ice crystals will make things happen, and you know, things like sun dogs. If you've never seen a sun dog, they'll blow your mind until you understand what they are. And, you know, the way that, you know, things like sprites in the upper atmosphere, which are enormous, you know, powerful electrical storms that could just wipe out cities if they land, God forbid, anything yeah. like that ever hit. So that's what I find so fascinating about the whole thing, because it's not a one-size-fits-all situation here at all.
I don't know how far we're going with this, but just before we end, I heard you... are you opposed to the idea of the activity at Skinwalker then, Paul?
all I'll say is I recently reread the book, Hunt for the Skinwalker.
Okay.
And obviously we've not had the... Because there's a series starting. I think it's going to be on the History Channel over here, which has started in the States already.
Yeah.
I just don't know what to take of that, because it's one of those phenomena, Paul, and I've said this about, you know, especially when it comes to cryptids, there are two possible explanations. The people are either lying or it happened. And if it's happened, it defies explanation.
Yeah. Well, I'm not got any great or strong views on the Skinwalker ranch, other than I do think that there's something there similar to what we're looking at on Eastern North Yorkshire coast, but I don't think Skinwalker's unique or necessarily Bempton and Speighton. I think these locations are all over the world. It just requires somebody to start lifting stones and unearthing these reports. Most of them will be historic, but it's still happening. So I mean, just the name sort of catches people's attention, doesn't it? The place in America. And, I suppose you are going to get showmen jumping on and wanting to work the location and get what they can out of it. But I'm not that quick to write it off. I do think that there's some I've spoken to a few American Indians who live close, but notably Larry Sespooch.
Yeah.
The stories that he's told me about that place, he's not ancient, but he's getting on a bit now, and he's lived there a lot of years, and he's told me some really interesting stuff. I sought his advice when I was looking into Flixton Werewolf early days. So I do think there is something to it, Paul, but whether it's all as what they say, I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I'm not dismissing it out of hand, because, you know, that isn't fair. There are certain aspects of that whole situation at Skinwalker Ranch that the strange lights and weird feelings and you know, some awful things that happened to animals and animal cattle mutilations, which, you know, is not unique for that particular area. But then again, you get, you know, like the woman of the family who were the original people that brought the story to attention. You know, she claims to have seen a wolf bigger than a car. Now, it's not that I'm saying it's pushing the bounds of credulity, Paul, but that's a phenomenon that bears no comparison, you know, and I'm no expert on Native American.
You're right, what you're saying there, it doesn't conform to what people have reported in the past. And I'll be honest with you, I'd never heard that, and it'll be true. I do believe you. But it's like when we're talking about the things that we're seeing up there, excuse me, and I'm talking about seeing squares of light.
Yeah.
They don't conform. People talk about seeing orbs of light up on the cliff tops. There's the rock anglers in particular, and we use them as an example quite often because they're the people up there on a night observing. But there's lots of them that talk about the ghost of big railings.
Yeah.
It's just a sphere of light that they see. But we're talking about squares of light. The police officer saw one with me. Gemma and Bob Brown saw the square of light. Myself and Steve Ashbridge have seen a square of light. You know, we'd both seen it together, not like separate. And they don't fit. They don't conform to what we're expecting to see, should we say? So I'm not saying that the wolf at the as big as a car existed, but these things, they do throw curveballs outside of the weirdness that they're already presenting. So I would say, once again, expect the unexpected. We just never know. I mean, I were up there last year, I don't know, June, July time, with another police officer, Dave Barnes. walking on the cliff tops, and Dave's going, whoa, look, 6 miles in the distance, Filey Brig, we're looking at it. Sphere of light comes out of Filey Brig. Anybody who's ever seen the bit of footage, I don't know if you've seen it, have you, Paul?
Yes.
I got it just as it levelled off, and then it travelled towards us. There was a wind blowing off the land out to sea. Yeah. It travelled 6 miles. I don't know how long it took. It was, but we worked. Well, Dave worked it out because I'm all right at talking. But it was doing up to 300 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And it did that in a short space of time, and went back into the sea, turned, come towards us, and went back into the sea. You can't deny what your eyes have seen, and you sort of, that's conforming to what people want to believe, if that makes sense. So that's a sphere of light, and it's travelling along top of ocean, and then it drops into the sea. But a square of light, it just doesn't fit. A huge mushroom of turquoise light just doesn't fit. Yeah. But these things are being reported. You know, I mean, this guy was West Garth at Caton, he saw what he perceived as a demon. But in the same location, we've got people reporting what they perceive as a werewolf.
Yeah.
What's happening? Do you know what I mean? If he wanted to bend the story, because he'll have maybe known about the Flixton stories, why did he say it looked like a demon and he's got short silver grey hair?
Yeah.
Why did he say, because I want to make this story up and talk to this guy, I saw a werewolf?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the most unusual things are a little bit more credible because of the fact that it's going against the grain of what we're expecting to hear.
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, it's one of those things because I've you know, mysterious lights come from all around the world. Probably the two most famous cases I can think off the top of my head are the Brown Mountain lights in the Carolinas in the States,
yeah.
And the Hessendalen lights in Norway, which are both... were originally explained as car lights, but then when you look at the Brown Mountain lights, those reports go back centuries, and you know it doesn't take a genius to work out that cars haven't been around for longer than 100 years, especially commonly.
You're spot on. You're so right. And what's interesting about the Norway, weren't it? The what is it? Hessendel.
Hessendel, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I spoke quite a lot to Philip Mantle about this. Do you know Philip?
Yes, I do. Pleasure. Lovely man.
Yeah, have you had him on your show? You need to get him on. He's so interesting.
Absolutely. He's a very busy man.
Yeah, I spoke to Philip quite a lot about these lights because he's got a friend in Norway. And years ago, he was sort of a lot more active because he's not been too well of lately. But, you know, many years ago, and he's been out there and they've looked. But what's interesting is Philip believes it's an Earth phenomena.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can get on with Philip. I mean, just because I think there's some awareness, some semblance of knowledge to these things and they're interacting, doesn't mean I'm right. Philip believes it's some kind of Earth phenomena.
Yeah.
Well, interestingly, his best friend, who was documenting them in Norway, is in the same mind as me. Intelligent light forms. There is an awareness to them. You know, and it's just differences of opinion, but we might both be right.
Yes.
Do you know what?
Yes.
It's a crazy one.
Absolutely, it is. It is, and I mean that takes you into a different realm entirely. And I've yet to put you to task in regards to your new book, Paul. So I think before I let you go, we need to mention that your nearest book, Night People, is almost upon us, is it not?
Oh, we're nearly there, and I'm really really pleased with this book. I mean, probably more so than other the Truth Proof books. So, yeah, Night People is just about there. We're just adding images to it now. You know, when I've spoken on radio in the past, I've spoke about the things that have happened to me, and I've said, look, I've got the doctor's medical records. Well, I don't mean they're all going to be in there, but the ones that are relevant, the punch hole lesions and the doctors saying we're quite perplexed about these lesions that are appearing on this man's body, because up until then it's only words. It's me saying it on radio and people can think he's full of it, that guy. Where's his proof? You know, the medical records are going to be in the book. It doesn't mean I've got irrefutable proof, because once again, we've only got our, you know, my word for it, your word for what you saw and experienced.
Yeah.
But I've written the Night People from my earliest memories to present day of the things that have happened, and obviously they've dragged my family into it, you know, my wife, my girls, as they've gone through life, they've all experienced things. Not, and it's not to a degree that they've not been scarred. But the grandchildren have started. The two of the boys have had experiences already, and we've changed the names in book. But it's happening. It's real. And you know, I mean, years and years ago, I would have never ever spoken about it. I say, spoke to Whitley Strieber in 2006, I think, when he asked me to go on his show, and I declined. And then when I decided to write Truth Proof, I went on then just basically to talk about the things in the book, but with a bit of prompting, I ended up talking about my own experiences, and I think that was 2015, and I've decided to write The Night People, and honestly, I love the book. I mean, that sounds ever so vain, doesn't it? But I absolutely...
Nothing wrong with being proud of yourself,
well,
Paul.
It's been good. It's almost been like a bloodletting, an exercise in...
Yes.
I was hoping when I started writing it that I would remember more, almost like a regression. And I've not remembered anything more. There's a story from what's called Church Street at Old Denneby that I've remembered a fraction more. After a lifetime of going through that cameo, that little memory, I can remember kicking all the leaves up so I could date it. Well, not date it, but the season. It was autumn.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've been about 6 years old, and there's a disused blacksmith's at Church Street. I think it got pulled down 20 years ago, but it were all boarded up, and there was some big sandstone steps, not steps, stones jutting out from it.
Yeah.
And the farrier used to use them. And I jumped on these stones and looked through, there was a piece of plywood smashed away, and I looked inside, and there was a glowing kiln, and there was a green leather sofa in it. Which shouldn't have been in it, and there shouldn't have been a kiln in it. It was locked up, it was sealed, it was disused. And an old lady, and she came to the window and looked at me. And I'm shouting my mum, and she's walking down Mexborough. The supermarket, I think, people were Hillard's. So I'm showing her age there.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't come, and I can see her, and she's looking at me, this old lady, and all the way back, I couldn't wait to get back because we had to walk. We walked from the village of Old Denneby, and I jumped on the stones. I told my mum all about it. I was so excited. Can't have been more than an hour. Went in, looked through the window, nothing. No kiln, no leather sofa, no old lady, just gone. And I didn't dream it. That happened. You know, what's interesting is I was born on the house next to it. On Church Street, this blacksmith was on the corner, like as a letter T, and you'd go up the road to what's called Quarry Street. And on the other side of Quarry Street, 30 foot away, was a little stone cottage, a row of cottages, and I was born in one of those cottages. What the correlation is, I don't know, because we didn't live there then. We lived at Old Denneby. We moved shortly after me being born in that cottage, but it's interesting. And it happened. So what we've got is cameos of events throughout my life, and I've tried to make it interesting. I've tried to, you know, paint a picture of what it was like. And once again, Paul, and I've said this a thousand times, the difficulty is we've not caught up with knowledge to know what we're dealing with, so we haven't created words for these things. We haven't created descriptions. We can't describe what we're actually seeing a lot of the time. You know, the word alien, we know that means some strange looking being, but we don't know what race of alien. We know we've got people saying that we've got these coming from this planet and this star system and all that. I've no idea, quite honestly. I just know, as a child, I saw these beings. For me, they're not coming from the stars. They're already here. People are telling me, you know, when we're going up to Bempton and we're seeing this unexplained phenomena, it's already here. Yeah. It's not travelling from space. It's here. Yeah. I think we have a better chance that it being some kind of parallel world than coming from light years. But just my take on it, people. I'm not... it's not my law, it's just my theories.
Yeah. I mean, it is strange, Paul, because it reminds me, obviously, I was... Some would say unfortunate, but I consider it fortunate because I grew up on the other side to where you grew up, because obviously you grew up in near Mexborough and I grew up the other side of Barnsley in a village called Darton. So I know Mexborough fairly well. I know exactly where you're talking about. So, but when I was a child, I used to have I used to call them the Whisperers.
Right.
And all I'll tell you is all I can ever remember that the last time I remember them. An experience with it, and I can't tell you, it might have been a dream. If it was an extremely lucid and vivid dream, I must have been 9 or 10, and I remember being stood up on my bed, and I could hear them. They kind of made a noise like a, like that. That's why I called them the Whisperers, because I could never quite make out what they were saying. But
yeah,
it's just like this hubbub of noise. And then all of a sudden, I seemed to be picked up and slid under the covers in my bed and went fast asleep. And that was the last time I remember anything like that strange happening.
How old would you have been then, do you think, Paul?
We'd just moved house, because we moved house when I was 7. And it happened, it was the only incident of any spookiness that ever happened in the new house we moved from. Because I grew up in a converted old vicarage. So
yeah,
if you're going to live in a haunted house, that's one to be.
Yeah.
So we moved to a new council house when I was a kid growing up. And that was the only thing. So I would probably have been no older than 10.
Right. Well, you know, I've heard the voices as well as a child. Mm. So not unlike what you've just described. But I'd have described them as demonic. They were frightening, you know.
Yeah.
But as I say, I suppose saying that you're pleased with the book is one thing. And we've just got to see how it's received. And I'm hoping I've done a good job on it and put the abduction phenomena over in a good light. I were hoping, like I said before, I mean, it's a struggle to really find the words to describe what you're talking about, and I were hoping I were going to find more answers once I started delving in and thinking deep about the stories, but it's not happened. There's been, I think there's two instances in the book, but there's no great revelations come through. Basically, I'm telling some of the same stories as what I told, or I have told on radio. There's a lot more in Night People than that. There's one story that I've written about that I won't talk about. But I had to write it, yeah, if that makes sense. Otherwise, I'd have been a disingenuous to myself and to the book.
Yeah.
But no, I'm pleased with it. That's about all I can say about it, Paul.
I mean, like you touched on there, Paul, have you found it cathartic? Do you feel better for unloading it?
I do, yeah. I felt instantly better after I'd spoken in 2015 to Whitley Strieber, and I started talking about the experiences.
Mm.
And it's almost like it's something that, because it's so real, because it's so graphic, because it's nothing in life affects you like this.
Mm.
And then, but you can't talk about it because people laugh at you, because people don't want to know. It's a frustration like no other.
Yeah.
So when you do begin to talk about it, it's such a relief. I can understand why people say nothing. There'll be people out there, maybe even listening to this, who've got far more traumatic or far more interesting stories to tell than what I've got.
Mm.
And I don't blame them for not talking. So sometimes it's easier to say nothing than face the world and than people knowing this guy thinks that he's been interfered with aliens, or this guy thinks that he's seen people from another planet or another sphere of existence.
Mm.
And that kind of feeling, for some people, it's better to just sort of grin and say nothing if the subject's brought up, than actually come out and start talking about it. I think if once the ball got rolling, and I think it's like a snowball effect, that's why I'm getting so much information and UFO reports coming through, Paul. I think once people start to unload and start to talk about these experiences, the more people that come forward, the more and more it will gather pace, because it's real. These aren't crazy imaginings. I can't imagine waking up with holes in my arms and holes in my back.
Yeah.
You know, and the doctors saying they're perplexed by the punch hole lesions.
Yeah.
And you can't imagine it. So I'm either doing it to myself.
Yep.
And these are on my back like bullet holes, or it's real.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've both got a mutual friend, Philip Kinsella.
Yeah.
Philip is a lovely man. He's intelligent. He's articulate. He's well spoken. He's very talented. But Philip is what would be classed, I'm not sure what the correct terms is these days. People call them experiencers. Me and you would probably consider them to be what we would call abductees.
Yeah.
Philip's story is terrifyingly compelling, but it's also rather mundane in the fact that it's set in a pretty standard, you know, there's no kind of crazy flashing lights and all this, and you know, throwing the kitchen sink at it, Paul. It's a very simple, yet clearly a very emotional part of his life. That has deeply affected him. And, you know, I had the privilege of speaking with Calvin Parker as well. You know, Calvin's story, and a prime example, encompasses exactly what you said, because he never said a word for 40-odd years because he'd seen the ridicule Charles Hickson had got. And Calvin just kept himself to himself because he just didn't want the harassment. And obviously, it ruined his life at that point because he basically thought he'd lost his mind.
It's the mental torture. Yeah. It's a mental torment. It really is. And, you know, I sort of feel for Philip Kinsella, and it's a brave thing to do, to come out and start talking about it. But I think it's only way, by people talking about it, it's the only way that we're going to get other people feeling bold enough to come out and share their stories. Then we might find more pieces of the puzzle and begin to, and not necessarily understand it, but make a little bit of sense of what's happening. Because what happens, you know, I mean, and I've not had one of these episodes since, not a traumatic one since about 1997, I think. Mm. And how do I know this? Because I've been getting pictures and medical notes and pictures together for to editor today. Yeah. Literally of the medical notes. And I've said this, you're not even aware they've been until they've gone.
Yeah.
That is the truth. When they've gone and you do remember what you do remember, it's vivid. And you can actually remember the build-up. You can actually remember what's happened on the build-up. But when it's happening, you're that rabbit caught in the headlights. And you know, the bullets hit you between the eyes before you realise what's happening. Mm. And it's only when they've gone that you actually realise it's happened. I don't know. Once again, is this intelligence, as it got, is it so far in advance that it's actually releasing chemicals in our body that create this static, this sort of frozen, almost anaesthetized human being, as they're approaching, as they're getting ready to do their procedure? Because We're clearly absolutely helpless when we're caught under their spell. Mm. Yeah. It's magic. It's to our eyes, it's magic.
Well, as Arthur C. Clarke famously said, any technology that is so advanced will seem like magic to humans.
Yeah, it's an exotic science. You know, it's intriguing. I can't switch off from it, and that's the sad part, really, because I wish I could.
Yeah.
I'll end this interview, you know, this radio chat that we've done today, and I'll go back there. I've got to get some pictures to Don, and then I've got other things to do, and then I've had to put phone off and my mobile as well, because there's people ringing all the time. Yeah. But I sound like I'm moaning, people. I'm not really, because I've craved not the attention, I've craved the sightings, I've craved the reports for years, because as a researcher, that's what you want.
Absolutely. It's your flesh and blood, Paul. It's your flesh and blood.
I thought you would say bread and butter. There's no money to be made from it.
No, big time. That's what I mean. That's why I didn't use the term bread and butter, Paul.
Well, thank you anyway. You know, it's been a great opportunity to speak.
Paul, it is always a pleasure to speak to you, my friend, both on and offline. You know, you're somebody whose work I've greatly appreciated. I'm delighted that we've become friends as well over the course of the last couple of years. You know, I've met you a couple of times. I've spoken to you numerous times. You're someone I'm always interested to find out what's going on, and I will be delighted to come and pop over when we're finally set free. So I will let you return to your family this evening, and I will thank you as always for your time, your conversation, and I wish you the very best with the night, people, my friend.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. Just one last thing, if I may. Mm. You need to get a cryptid researcher on called Robbie Shankland.
I will do. I shall look him up on your provisor.
I'll put you in touch with him. Great guy.
Brilliant. Well, I'll do you that.
Underestimated.
Fantastic. Right, I'll do that. And in response, I will send you that excerpt from Skinwalker Ranch that I was mentioning about the wolf. I'll send you that as well later on tonight, mate.
Thank you very much, sir. And a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care.